The resolution affirms our commitment to the development of an internationally recognized representative government of Iraq. It creates a robust mandate for a special representative of the Secretary General.
And those who sit around the Security Council in their very privileged and powerful positions have already collectively punished the people of Iraq for almost 13 years. They have to take responsibility, from my mind, for the crimes that have been committed in the name of UN sanctions.
As we lurch from crisis to crisis, beamed directly into our brains by satellite TV, we have to think on our feet, on the move. We enter histories through the rubble of war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, May 22, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown.
After more than a decade of being frozen out of the world economy, it is time for the Iraqi people to benefit from their natural resources.
With these words, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Negroponte announced this morning that the U.N. Security Council had voted to lift the 12-year-old economic sanctions on Iraq and phase out the humanitarian oil for food program over a six-month time period. The sanctions were imposed after Iraq's 1991 invasion of neighboring Kuwait, and according to UNICEF and other development organizations, they were responsible for the deaths of over 5,000 children a month due to malnutrition and preventable diseases. Despite French concern that today's resolution would give a, quote, insufficient role to the United Nations in the rebuilding of Iraq, as well as Russian demands that UN weapons inspectors certify that Iraq is free of weapons of mass destruction before the sanctions are lifted, the final vote was 14-0 in favor of lifting the sanctions, with only Syria abstaining. Speaking after the vote, U.S. Ambassador John Negroponte announced the creation of a development fund for the rebuilding of Iraq to be controlled by Iraq's central bank, and he detailed some of the changes that will now go into effect.
The resolution lifts export restrictions to Iraq, with the exception of trade in arms and related materiel not required by the Coalition Provisional Authority. Aviation restrictions are also lifted, but Iraq's disarmament obligations remain, and member states remain barred from assisting Iraq in acquiring weapons of mass destruction, proscribed missile systems, or proceeding with civil nuclear activities, so long as those restrictions remain in effect. The resolution provides Iraq with adequate time to recover capacity eroded during the sanctions years, yet it preserves its obligations to Kuwait and others who suffered from Saddam Hussein's aggression, dating from 1990. It addresses Iraq's sovereign debt, protection of Iraqi antiquities, and accountability for serious violations of human rights and international humanitarian law by the previous regime.
U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Negroponte. Following the vote, U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan responded to reporters' questions.
Are you uncomfortable with what this resolution does, which is basically authorize this occupation after a war which was not sanctioned by the United Nations? Are you uncomfortable with this, although you are faced with a reality here, and uncomfortable with the precedent that it may set?
I think the resolution gives the international community a legal basis for its activities in Iraq. And as you saw today, the council members voted unanimously for it. We have been given specific assignments, and the Council has provided a legal basis, and we'll go ahead and do our work.
UN Secretary General Kofi Annan responding to reporters' questions this morning after 14 members of the Security Council voted to lift the 12-year-old economic sanctions in Iraq. Against Syria was the lone abstention. Dennis Halliday was the UN's humanitarian coordinator in Iraq and the director of the Oil for Food Program until his 1998 resignation in protest over what he called the West, quote, genocidal sanctions against that country. Halliday discussed a Security Council vote with Robert Knight and Sharan Harper on Pacifica Station WBAI's wake-up call, where he expressed relief that the sanctions will be lifted and regret that they had been imposed in the first place.
I'm delighted we're finally lifting United Nations sanctions off the backs of the people of Iraq. These sanctions have been catastrophic. They've been collective punishment. They've been genocidal. So that is good news. Secondly, to stop looting. The UN has been looting Iraq now for over 5 or 6 years. $20 billion of Iraqi revenue has been given away in reparations to Kuwait, which nobody else on earth has paid since, First World War. And this at a time when the children have been dying in Iraq for lack of infrastructure, health care, education, and other needs. So I think we have to see a United Nations providing oversight, and perhaps the word is protection. Protection from the occupying powers. The Security Council has failed already to prevent the U.S. and Britain going to war against Iraq out of international law, totally illegally. Having failed there, now at least the UN has to protect Iraq from these same occupying forces, to protect the Iraqi economy from the World Bank, from the IMF, who would be anxious to take over and impose structural adjustment programs and other programs which will deny the Iraqis the same human rights they've been denied under the United Nations sanctions.
Is money being taken off the top through the United States process of having Iraq pay for itself, having been invaded in what the Secretary General called something not in conformity with the Charter of the UN?
Well, you've put your finger on a great danger. I mean, the so-called Iraq Development Fund, which has now been established, will have, I believe, an initial funding of $3 billion. Now, these $3 billion are directly from oil revenue that belongs to the Iraqi people. So from the very beginning, it looks as though the United Nations, the United States, Britain are going to use Iraqi money to rebuild this country or start the process of rebuilding this country. And that means Iraqi money will be going straight into the coffers of Halliburton, of Bechtel, and other American companies who've gotten these contracts without a legal international bidding process and without any consultation with the people who own this money, i.e. the Iraqi people. And if Mr. Bremer gets his way and we've no interim government that has real representation of Shia, Sunni, Kurds, and other minorities in this country of Iraq, I think this is just another outrage and is indeed undermining the rights of the Iraqi, its sovereign integrity.
What is your assessment of the current resolution before the council?
Well, of concern to me has been the fact that the Secretary General, for some reason, has failed to outline what he considers to be the minimal oversight role of this United Nations coordinator. So none of us know exactly what he envisages. There's no vision. So it seems to me that the Council has got to work very hard on encouraging the United States and Britain to accept a greater role, somebody appointed by the Council or by the Secretary General who'd have real stature in Iraq alongside Mr. Bremer and would protect Iraq politically, but very importantly, countrywide elections on a multi-party system, I would hope, in the next 6 months. There's no reason that cannot be done. We tend to forget here in the States that Iraqis have been electing members of the National Assembly in Baghdad for years. This is not something new to them.
What can happen now to restore confidence in the UN as a peacekeeping organization and to, in a way, prevent this type of aggression from taking place again?
I think for the people of this country, who, after all, are responsible for every aspect of foreign policy, including the war in Iraq, the loss of thousands of civilians, the tremendous damage to the infrastructure, and the loss of life of their own military in this crazed and aggressive endeavor, which has no basis in law. These good people of the United States, I think, need to convey to their representatives that this is not satisfactory, that the failure to adjust to a peaceful occupation and bring to the Iraqi people, first of all, their very basic human rights of life, of health care, of education, and water, of course, is a fundamental failure on the part of the United States. They must meet their obligations under international law. They cannot be allowed to rape and pillage this country as the UN has done now for, many, many years. That's got to change. And that members of the Congress in Washington need to hear from individual Americans that they are deeply concerned that having failed on Afghanistan and the reports coming in from there are just tragic in the failure of the U.S. to put the money that they promised into that reconstruction process. Are we going to do the same in Iraq? It looks awfully similar, and we must guard against that. So every American citizen has a responsibility. And those who sit around the Security Council in their very privileged and powerful positions have already collectively punished the people of Iraq for almost 13 years. They have to take responsibility, from my mind, for the crimes that have been committed in the name of UN sanctions. And they're going to have to now, I think, come around quickly and make a decision to move forward, giving the Iraqi people the sovereignty that is their right, restoring their human rights, that is the basic human rights, economic and social, and of course beginning the process of protecting their civil and political rights that were neglected under the regime in Baghdad in recent years. They have a huge responsibility. They cannot afford to again play games with the Iraqi people, given their own self-vested interests, as they look at Iraq as some sort of money cow which can be milked for billions of dollars in the years ahead.
Dennis Halliday is the former director of the United Nations Oil for Food Program in Iraq. He spoke with Robert Knight and Sharan Harper on Pacifica Station WBAI's Wake Up Call. The biggest U.S. defense budget since the Cold War is being rammed through Congress by the Republican majority this week, despite persistent questions over waste and the Pentagon's own admission that it cannot account for more than $1 trillion. The 2004 military spending request of over $400 billion does not even include the occupation of Iraq, which will be covered by a later supplemental bill of up to $35 billion. Very little of the money will go towards the war on terrorism or homeland security, which are principally paid for by other agencies like the FBI and the CIA. The threat of more terrorist attacks has created public and congressional support for a ballooning defense budget, but the lion's share of the money is being spent on traditional weapons, such as the jet fighters and submarines originally designed to fight the Soviet Union. Gunmen fired anti-tank rockets at a U.S. armored vehicle in the tense Iraqi town of Fallujah, sending U.S. troops into a shooting spree that killed two Iraqis. That's according to residents. As chaos continues in Iraq, we present this speech today of Arundhati Roy, the Indian political essayist, at the Riverside Church in New York City about the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the destruction of the art museum, and the end of any law and order in Iraqi cities.
In these times when we have to race to keep abreast of the speed at which our freedoms are being snatched from us, and when few can afford the luxury of retreating from the streets for a while in order to return with an exquisite, fully formed political thesis, replete with footnotes and references, what profound gift can I offer you tonight? As we lurch from crisis to crisis, beamed directly into our brains by satellite TV, we have to think on our feet, on the move. We enter histories through the rubble of war, ruined cities, parched fields, shrinking forests, and dying rivers are our archives. Craters left by daisy cutters are libraries. So what can I offer you tonight? Some uncomfortable thoughts about money, war, empire, racism, and democracy. Some worries that flit around my brain like a family of persistent moths that keep me awake at night. Some of you will think it bad manners for a person like me, officially entered in the big book of nations as an Indian citizen, to come here and criticize the US government. But speaking for myself, I'm no flag waver, no patriot, and I'm fully aware that venality, brutality, and hypocrisy are imprinted on the leaden soul of every nation. But when a country ceases to be merely a country and becomes an empire, then the scale of operations changes dramatically. So may I clarify that tonight I speak as a subject of the American empire. I speak as a slave who presumes to criticize her king. Since lectures must be called something, mine tonight is called Instant Mix Imperial Democracy. Buy one, get one free. Way back in 1988, on the 3rd of July, the USS Vincennes, a missile cruiser stationed in the Persian Gulf, accidentally shot down an Iranian airliner and killed 290 civilian passengers. George Bush I, who was at the time on his presidential campaign, was asked to comment on the incident. He said, quite subtly, I will never apologize for the United States. I don't care what the facts are. I don't care what the facts are. What a perfect maxim for the new American empire. Perhaps a slight variation on the theme would be more apposite. The facts can be whatever we want them to be. When the United States invaded Iraq, a New York Times CBS News survey estimated that 42% of the American public believed that Saddam Hussein was directly responsible for the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. And an ABC News poll said that 55% of Americans believed that Saddam Hussein directly supported al-Qaeda. None of this opinion is based on evidence, because there isn't any. All of it is based on insinuation, auto-suggestion, and outright lies circulated by the U.S. corporate media, otherwise known as the free press, that hollow pillar on which contemporary American democracy rests. Public support in the U.S. for the war against Iraq was founded on a multi-tiered edifice of falsehood and deceit, coordinated by the U.S. government and faithfully amplified by the corporate media. Apart from the invented links between Iraq and al-Qaeda, we had the manufactured frenzy about Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. George Bush the Lesser went to the extent of saying it would be suicidal for the U.S. not to attack Iraq. We once again witnessed the paranoia that a starved, bombed, besieged country was about to annihilate almighty America. Iraq was only the latest in a succession of countries. Earlier there was Cuba, Nicaragua, Libya, Granada, Panama. But this time it wasn't just your ordinary brand of friendly neighborhood frenzy. It was frenzy with a purpose. It ushered in an old doctrine in a new bottle, the doctrine of preemptive strike, also known as the United States can do whatever the hell it wants, and that's official. The war against Iraq has been fought and won, and no weapons of mass destruction have been found, not even a little one. Perhaps they'll have to be planted before they're discovered. And then the more troublesome amongst us will need an explanation for why Saddam Hussein didn't use them when his country was being invaded. Of course, there'll be no answers. Meanwhile, in passing, an ancient civilization has been casually decimated by a very recent, casually brutal nation. Then there are those who say, so what if Iraq had no chemical and nuclear weapons? So what if there's no al-Qaeda connection? So what if Osama bin Laden hates Saddam Hussein as much as he hates the United States? Bush the Lesser has said Saddam Hussein was a homicidal dictator. And so the reasoning goes, Iraq needed a regime change. After the first Gulf War, the Allies fomented an uprising of Shias in Basra and then looked away while Saddam Hussein crushed the revolt and slaughtered thousands in an act of vengeful reprisal. The point is, if Saddam Hussein was evil enough to merit the most elaborate, openly declared assassination attempt in history, the opening move of Operation Shock and Awe, then surely those who supported him ought at least to be tried for war crimes? Because when it comes to empire, facts don't matter. Yes, but all that's in the past, we are told. Saddam Hussein is a monster who must be stopped now, and only the U.S. can stop him. It's an effective technique, this use of the urgent morality of the present to obscure the diabolical sins of the past and the malevolent plans for the future. Indonesia, Panama, Nicaragua, Iraq, Afghanistan, the list goes on and on. Right now, there are brutal regimes being groomed for the future. Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Pakistan, the Central Asian republics. U.S. Attorney General John Ashcroft recently declared that U.S. freedoms are, and I quote, not the grant of any government or document, but our endowment from God. Why bother with the United Nations when God himself is on hand? So here we are, the people of the world, confronted with an empire armed with a mandate from heaven, and as added insurance, the most formidable arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in history. Here we are, confronted with an empire that has conferred upon itself the right to go to war at will, and the right to deliver people from corrupting ideologies, from religious fundamentalists, dictators, sexism, and poverty, by the age-old, tried and tested practice of extermination. Empire is on the move, and democracy is its sly new war cry. Democracy, home delivered to your doorstep by daisy cutters. Death is a small price for people to pay for the privilege of sampling this new product, instant mix imperial democracy. Bring to a boil, add oil, then bomb. But then, perhaps, chinks, Negroes, dinks, gooks, and wogs don't really qualify as real people. Perhaps our deaths don't qualify as real deaths. Our histories don't qualify as history. They never have. Speaking of history, in these past months, while the world watched, the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq was broadcast on live television. Like Osama bin Laden and the Taliban in Afghanistan, the regime of Saddam Hussein simply disappeared. This was followed by what analysts call a power vacuum. Cities that had been under siege without food, water, and electricity for days, cities that had been bombed relentlessly, people who had been starved and systematically impoverished by the UN-sanctioned regime for more than a decade, were suddenly left with no semblance of urban administration. A 7,000-year-old civilization slid into anarchy on live TV. Vandals plundered shops, offices, hotels, and hospitals. American and British soldiers stood by and watched. They said they had no orders to act. In effect, they had orders to kill people, but not to protect them. Their priorities were clear. The safety and security of Iraqi people was not their business. The security of whatever little remained of Iraq's infrastructure was not their business. But the security and safety of Iraq's oil fields were. Of course they were. The oil fields were secured almost before the invasion began. On CNN and BBC, the scenes of the rampage were played and replayed. TV commentators, army and government spokespersons portrayed it as a liberated people venting their rage at a despotic regime. U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said, and I quote, "It's untidy, freedom's untidy, and free people are free to commit crimes and make mistakes and do bad things." Did anybody know that Donald Rumsfeld was an anarchist? I wonder, did he hold the same view during the riots in Los Angeles following the beating of Rodney King? Would he care to share his thesis about the untidiness of freedom with the 2 million people being held in U.S. prisons right now? The world's freest country has the highest number of prisoners in the world. Would he discuss its merits with young African-American men, 28% of whom will spend some part of their adult lives in jail? Could he explain why he serves under a president who oversaw 152 executions when he was governor of Texas? Before the war on Iraq began, the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance, the ORHA, sent the Pentagon a list of 16 crucial sites to protect. The National Museum was second on that list. And yet the museum was not just looted, it was desecrated. It was a repository of an ancient cultural heritage. Iraq, as we know it today, was part of the River Valley civilization of Mesopotamia, the civilization that grew along the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates, produced the world's first writing, first calendar, first library, first city, and yes, the world's first democracy. King Hammurabi of Babylon was the first to codify laws governing the social life of citizens. It was a code in which abandoned women, prostitutes, slaves, and even animals had rights. The Hammurabi Code is acknowledged not just as the birth of legality, but the beginning of an understanding of the concept of social justice. The U.S. government could not have chosen a more inappropriate land in which to stage its illegal war and display its grotesque disregard for justice of any kind. The last building on the ORHA list of 16 sites to be protected was the Ministry of Oil. It was the only one that was given protection. Perhaps the occupying army thought that in Muslim countries, lists are read upside down. On the 2nd of May, Bush the Lesser launched his 2004 campaign, hoping to be finally elected U.S. president. In what probably constitutes the shortest flight in history, a military jet landed on an aircraft carrier, the USS Abraham Lincoln, which was so close to the shore that, according to the Associated Press, administration officials acknowledged, quote, positioning the massive ship to provide the best TV angle for Bush's speech with the sea as his background instead of the San Diego coastline. President Bush, who never served his term in the military, emerged from the cockpit in fancy dress, a U.S. military bomber jacket, combat boots, flying goggles, helmet. Waving to his cheering troops, he officially proclaimed victory over Iraq. He was careful to say that it was, quote, just one victory in the war on terror, which still goes on. It was important to avoid making a straightforward victory announcement because under the Geneva Convention, a victorious army is bound by legal obligations of an occupying force, a responsibility that the Bush administration doesn't want to burden itself with. And also closer to the 2004 elections, in order to woo wavering voters, another victory in the war against terror might be necessary. Syria is being fattened for the kill. It was Hermann Göring, that old Nazi, who said, people can always be brought to the bidding of leaders. All you have to do is to tell them they are being attacked and denounce the pacifists for a lack of patriotism and exposing the country to danger. It works the same way in any country. He's right. It's dead easy. That's what the Bush regime banks on. The distinction between election campaigns and war, between democracy and oligarchy, seems to be closing fast. The only caveat in these campaign wars is that U.S. lives must not be lost. It shakes voter confidence. But the problem of U.S. soldiers being killed in combat has been licked more or less. At a media briefing before Operation Shock and Awe was unleashed, General Tommy Franks announced, this campaign will be like no other in history. Maybe he's right. I'm no military historian, but when was the last time a war was fought like this? After using the good offices of UN diplomacy, economic sanctions, and weapons inspections to ensure that Iraq was brought to its knees, its people starved, 500,000 children dead, its infrastructure severely damaged, after making sure that most of its weapons had been destroyed, in an act of cowardice that must surely be unrivaled in history, the coalition of the willing, better known as the coalition of the bullied and bought, sent in an invading army. Operation Iraqi Freedom? I don't think so. It was more like Operation Let's Run a Race, but first let me break your knees. As soon as the war began, the governments of France, Germany, and Russia, which refused to allow a final resolution legitimizing the war to be passed in the UN Security Council, fell over each other to say how much they wanted the United States to win. President Jacques Chirac offered French airspace to the Anglo-American Air Force. US military bases in Germany were open for business. German Foreign Minister Joschka Fischer publicly hoped for the rapid collapse of the Saddam Hussein regime. Vladimir Putin publicly hoped for the same. These are governments that colluded in the enforced disarming of Iraq before their dastardly rush to take the side of those who attacked it. Apart from hoping to share the spoils, they hoped empire would honor their pre-war oil contracts with Iraq. Only the very naive could expect old imperialists to behave otherwise.
Indian political essayist Arundhati Roy. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment, and when we do, we'll continue with more of Arundhati Roy and that speech at the Riverside Church in New York.